From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. In the Oval Office this morning, President Biden described the deaths of 13 American service members at the hands of a suicide bomber in Kabul as tragic. Nevertheless, the president is pressing forward with the plan to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan in the next 4 days.
I met with my commanders this morning, first thing in the morning, got a detailed briefing about yesterday's attacks and the measures they're taking to protect our forces and complete the mission. And we will complete the mission.
U.S. officials told the Associated Press today that at least 169 Afghans died in yesterday's attack, and that number is tragically not final. Last night, Biden said the U.S. will hunt down the terrorists responsible. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Jesse Holland is a Saturday host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Hi, Jesse.
Good afternoon.
Here is the president last night speaking about the deaths of 13 service members and many Afghans who were trying to flee the country.
I bear responsibility for fundamentally all that's happened of late.
So, Jesse, what stuck out for you from the president's remarks?
Well, what stuck out to me was that the president would refuse to back off any from the withdrawal deadline. He did mourn the loss of American life, mourn the loss of lives in Afghanistan, but it did not change his mind at all about the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. Even though he's facing major criticism from Republicans and even some Democrats on this move, he is not changing his mind about getting America out of one of its longest wars.
And Rick, there's a lot of heated coverage right now in light of the attacks yesterday and the attempt to get people out of Afghanistan as quickly as possible. But how are you sort of placing all of these events into context, the full context of the war?
This is going to be a long withdrawal process, and it won't even end on August 31st with the admission this week that it's almost certain that some Americans and Afghan allies are going to be left behind. President Biden continues to say he will be committed to those as well, but I think yesterday's events just underscore how difficult that is. You have a Taliban government that had been fighting with the United States for 20 years that is now our best shot at getting Americans safely out and keeping the peace afterward. Yesterday's attack, supposedly by ISIS-K, underscores that. You've got now terrorists who are fighting with an insurgency. Lots of enemies of each other at the same time, and all of this at the same time that America's security interests will be tested like no other.
This is something that Florida Congressman Mike Waltz was talking about on CNN this morning. He's a Republican and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. His point of view is that the United States is actually in a worse place now than we were on September 10th, 2001. And he said that Biden's threat to hunt down the attackers rang hollow since there won't be any troops there after next week.
I think that was to look tough and to tell the nation that there'll be some type of response. But logistically, militarily, I think it's going to be incredibly challenging.
Rick, this is going to be difficult, isn't it? The president promised to get out of the war, but now he's suddenly faced with 13 dead American service members, and there is pressure for him to respond forcefully. What kind of bind does this put him in?
Yeah. At least the possibility of another shooting war with American troops. And look, there's lots of places in the world where the U.S. military retains some sort of a counterterrorism over-the-horizon presence. Afghanistan could easily be one of those. But the idea that we're going to be able to hunt down those killers without having any kind of a footprint in Afghanistan seems a bit far-fetched, especially as we try to forge a relationship with people that we've been fighting against for 20 years. So I think it also didn't fit with the broader theme, Biden talking about the need to extricate ourselves. This is involvement, and this means that, as justified as it may be to hunt down the killers of 13-plus Americans, it means you're going to have to be involved militarily.
Jesse, you had hinted at the political pressure that the president is facing, even for members of his own party, not to mention Republicans. What do you think is likely to come out of Congress, if anything, as this situation develops?
Well, I think Congress abdicated its war-making powers to the executive branch years ago. And therefore, without much congressional intervention, you'll see President Joe Biden decide himself what should be done. Congress may criticize, but I don't think you'll see lawmakers actually do anything. For the last few conflicts, going all the way back to Vietnam and beforehand, Congress has been hands-off when it comes to actual war strategy in the United States. They may complain, they may criticize, but they won't order the president to do anything. And keep in mind, Biden is a veteran of the Obama administration. And the Obama administration was known for its drone use in the war against terror. So even though there might not be boots on the ground in Afghanistan, don't think that the U.S. military cannot still find a way to get those people who killed American lives in Afghanistan, even without having thousands of troops on the ground in Afghanistan.
So, Jesse, if this is all on the president, how do you think this week might shape the rest of his presidency?
Well, believe me, I'm sure the White House did not expect to have this to be a major crisis going into the fall and going into the fall elections and the midterms elections. The White House is hoping that things will calm down before we hit the congressional elections next year. And perhaps maybe that's the reason why they made the decision to make this move now, to give themselves time and space before the congressional elections. But right now, this is clearly the most a tragic situation that President Joe Biden has had to deal with. How he responds will shape how the rest of his administration goes between now and the midterm elections.
Rick, speaking of the elections, there is a lot of concern among his party about the president's poll numbers falling. But I wonder, do you think there's a danger in citing opinion polls too much, especially when we're talking about foreign policy and complicated military maneuvers?
Oh, sure. Look, the American public was widely on board with the idea of ending the war of Afghanistan until things took a turn south. The White House, in fact, is among those trumpeting those numbers up until very recently. But I think there's something interesting going on. Because Joe Biden's numbers have been so steady over the first 7 months or so in office, his approval rating never seemed to move up or down, really. It was always in the low to mid-50s. Now it's in the high 40s, and it's not necessarily a time for sounding alarms. But the fact that his disapproval is about as high as his approval rating, even if it might just be temporary, it shows that something significant is happening in the public, that this is registering, that this is getting through, that maybe the combination of concerns around the Delta variant, around inflation, and of course Afghanistan are leading to some changed perceptions around President Biden. And I think that impacts the entire agenda going forward. Even if he bounces back a bit, even if things calm down, as Jesse said, we move on from Afghanistan, it shows you that he doesn't have a bulletproof set of supporters, that his approval rating can actually move up and down. This is the first major hit he's taken.
Well, let's move on from Afghanistan, as you said, Rick, and talk a bit about the Supreme Court, because yesterday the conservative majority of the court struck down the Biden administration's latest ban on evictions during the pandemic. That was based on CDC guidance, by the way. In a statement this morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the Supreme Court immorally ripped away help for struggling renters. It now falls on Congress to stop evictions if the House and Senate choose to do that. Any chance of that happening, Jesse?
Absolutely not. I don't see Congress getting together and making a decision against landlords. I mean, even though Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh signaled a long time ago that the Supreme Court would not allow another moratorium to be held up, Congress has had its time since then to make some kind of move to keep millions of Americans from being evicted when the moratorium ends. Now the moratorium is over. The Supreme Court did what it said it was going to do. And it's just not realistic that Congress all of a sudden is going to make a move between now and the next 2 or 3 weeks to save Americans from being evicted from their homes because of the coronavirus pandemic.
You know, that's right, Rick. The Biden administration had to know this was not going to get past the Supreme Court. It said as much. So what's the next move for the White House, then, if it's not going to get through Congress either?
We're seeing the White House trying to apply pressure on states and localities that might have the power to do this on their own. Many people that are in danger of being evicted are covered by state or local moratoriums. But this is a loss, and it's a loss at the hands of the court. And it underscores the stakes of the court. And just today, Justice Stephen Breyer telling the New York Times that he is thinking about political considerations in mulling a retirement. Those three liberal members are the last vanguard for a lot of Democrats. And there's a possibility of a court confirmation hearing with the Democrats in control next year. That is something a lot of Democrats would like to see Justice Breyer step aside to be able to make that happen.
Well, that would be something that we will all be keeping a close eye on. You know, a lot of news really did get lost this week because of Afghanistan. But that $3.5 trillion budget resolution for the larger of the two infrastructure bills did pass the House just a few days ago. Jesse, just catch us up. We have about a minute here. Where do we stand? How close are we to a deal on infrastructure?
Well, hopefully we'll see something come through on infrastructure as soon as possible. Of course, Congress moves at its own pace. We do know if Congress can make a deal, President Biden would be more than happy to sign it. Hopefully, we'll see something going to the White House soon. But you know what? Right now, Democrats are arguing within their own party between its moderate and its liberal wing. And we'll have to wait and see if they can come to an agreement so President Biden can sign what is considered to be one of his signature bills.
Jesse Holland, Saturday host of C-SPAN's Washington Journal, and Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. It's always a pleasure to speak with both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Yesterday's attack in Kabul has complicated the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, but a number of NATO allies have already ended their missions in the country. Several completed their last evacuation flights out of Afghanistan this week, including Canada, Hungary, Poland, and Germany. NPR's Rob Schmitz has been following this from Berlin. Rob, welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
And what's been the reaction in Germany to yesterday's bombing in Kabul?
Yeah, Chancellor Angela Merkel called the attack vile, and she canceled a planned trip to Israel to help manage withdrawing German troops and citizens from Afghanistan, as well as seeking refuge for the thousands of Afghans who have arrived here in Germany.
The last German military aircraft from Afghanistan did leave yesterday as well. So tell me about the end of Germany's mission in the country and whether any of its citizens were left behind.
Yeah, so Germany has formally finished their mission in the country, and they did so before the deadline of August 31st that the U.S. set for its troops. And if you look at what's happened in Kabul in the past 2 weeks, from the taking of the city by the Taliban to the terror attack at the Kabul airport yesterday, the German government felt the situation in the city was far too dangerous for it to justify keeping any of its nationals there. The German foreign ministry doesn't have an accurate count of how many Germans remain in Afghanistan, but it estimates that there are still a couple hundred citizens there. Germany's defense ministry has suspended all airlifts due to the worsening security situation in Kabul, but the foreign minister says Germany will continue to try and seek an exit plan for those who are still there.
You mentioned some of the refugees trying to get into the country, into Germany. How welcoming will Germany be for those people?
Well, you know, Germany is a popular destination for refugees from throughout the developing world precisely because of the assistance it offers those seeking asylum. Here in Berlin, the government pays for accommodation, for food and health care to asylum seekers. It also offers pocket money as well as cards for free public transportation. And once an asylum seeker is on the path to citizenship, Germany also gives state subsidized language training courses that are aimed at getting refugees German to a level where they can function in a workplace and contribute to German society. You know, Germany has an excellent and well-worn track record at this.
But how are people inside Germany feeling about bringing more Afghans in? Because I know the issue of Syrian refugees coming to Germany has caused tension over the past few years.
Yeah, this varies, you know, depending on who you talk to. You know, many Germans see taking in Afghans as a duty to those who need help and who have helped its mission in Afghanistan for the nearly two decades now. But others are sort of weary of their country taking in more migrants. You know, 6 years ago, Chancellor Angela Merkel made the decision to accept hundreds of thousands of migrants from Syria, Iraq, and parts of North Africa, as well as Afghanistan. And that decision led to increasing popular support for the main far-right political party, Alternative for Deutschland. Their main complaint was that Germany was accepting far too many migrants and that this would lead to higher crime rates and a threat to German society. But a poll released this week by German broadcaster ZDF showed that nearly two-thirds of German voters believe their country is still able to cope with more refugees.
But there is a change coming at the top. Merkel is going to step down after 16 years in office. The country will have federal elections, I think September 26th, to replace her. How do you think a change in leadership will affect the country's position on asylum seekers?
Yeah, Germany has not only become the primary destination for asylum seekers in Europe, but also for the developed world. You know, Germany's taken in far more refugees from Afghanistan than the U.S. has. And it's got a proven track record of doing more than most countries to integrate those refugees into society. So we're now in a situation where Germany is set to take in around 4,000 more Afghan refugees. And when you compare that number to the around 1 million migrants that came to Germany 6 years ago, it pales in comparison. So it's unlikely Germany will have problems absorbing these newest refugees. But that doesn't mean that they won't become political pawns. You know, you mentioned the German federal elections next month. We're already seeing the chancellor candidate for Merkel's own party, Armin Laschet, saying his country cannot cope with an influx of migrants like Germany saw 6 years ago. Now, of course, these latest migrants are nowhere near what we saw 6 years ago. So it's hard not to see that statement as a political one meant to get more votes from right-wing voters. You know, overall, though, Germany seems to be prepared to cope with these newest Afghan refugees.
NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
This morning, Pentagon officials announced they expect more terrorist attack attempts to follow yesterday's bombing near Kabul airport. Officials say 13 American service members and at least 169 Afghans died. For months, critics have worried that the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan would embolden terrorist groups in the region. And here to tell us more about the security implications of the fall of Afghanistan is retired Admiral James Stavridis. He's a former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and oversaw the mission in Afghanistan from 2009 to 2013. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Celeste.
I'm glad that we have someone with so much knowledge of the complicated situation in Afghanistan to talk to. I wonder, for a civilian like myself, what can you tell me to help me understand what happened yesterday?
Well, let's start by recognizing the families of the 13 servicemen who died defending this country. And in the midst of a humanitarian operation, they're having the worst day of their lives. And we ought to just pause for a second and recognize that. Celeste, what happened yesterday was the culmination, in some ways, of 20 years of effort in Afghanistan. And it came to a tragic ending. It developed more recently, tactically, over the past couple of months as a combination of things happened. We didn't have the best intelligence on the status of the Afghan forces. Some of the long-term training that we did with the Afghans to prepare them failed us. The Taliban performed superbly. Several Afghan leaders, including the president, Ashraf Ghani, simply decamped. So when you put all that together, you end up with a very perilous situation as the United States correctly tries to get our American citizens, our green card holders, and our Afghan allies and partners safely out of Kabul.
When we spoke to you back in July, you listed a number of things that you hoped would not happen in Afghanistan, and that included the fall of Kabul to Taliban control and a chaotic evacuation reminiscent of the end of the Vietnam War. Both of those have now happened. What went wrong? At what link in the chain? Which one broke?
No one thing broke. And when we talked last, I said I thought there was perhaps a 1 in 3 chance that things would remain relatively stable and that there was a 2 in 3 chance that the wheels would really come off. And unfortunately, that is what has happened. Again, a combination of faulty intelligence, bad decisions about training the Afghan security forces, the sudden withdrawal of support to those Afghan security officers, the fact that the Afghan governmental leadership suddenly departed. The Taliban simply did a very good job. They had sanctuaries from Pakistan. Celeste, all those things came together to create the scenario we're in. And then to jump on top of that, the Islamic State, Khorasan, a splinter group of the Islamic State, saw an opportunity to humiliate the United States, to strike a blow against the new Taliban government, and they took it.
President Biden said the U.S. will retaliate against the attackers of the airport bombing. Here he is yesterday.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. we will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
You know, Admiral, those remarks echo former President Bush's remarks that he made after 9/11, but this time the U.S. is leaving Afghanistan rather than invading. How do you place these remarks in context of the fact that we are removing boots on the ground from Afghanistan?
It becomes perhaps not mission impossible, to back up the president's words, but it's going to be mission very, very hard. And so assuming that we can over time develop sufficiently precise targeting information, and my guess is that the Islamic State is probably operating out of caves and mountain structures in eastern Afghanistan, much as Al-Qaeda did in the Tora Bora region. It seems to me that we're going to have to get that intelligence and then come in over the horizon, as the president likes to use the phrase. And we can do that. We can come in from great distances, from our bases in the Arabian Gulf, from our base in Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. We can have carriers come up and get within 300 miles of Afghanistan, which is itself, of course, landlocked, but off the coast of Pakistan. So we will have options. The challenge, Celeste, is going to be getting the intelligence now that we have left. Doing that will be a combination of overhead sensors, cyber, monitoring cell. I suspect the CIA will keep some kind of network in place. I don't think it's going to be happening in the next few days, but I think over time we will, as we found bin Laden, we will find the killers in this case.
We only have about 30 seconds left, though, Admiral, and I just wanted to mention that the military has taken action trying to dismantle ISIS-K before this and was unsuccessful. What are the chances they can do it now?
I think they are reasonably good, actually. And if you stop and think about 5 years ago, the Islamic State was rolling toward Baghdad, seemingly unstoppable. We stopped them at the gates of Baghdad. We'll stop them in Afghanistan.
Retired Admiral James Stavridis is a former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Celeste.
NPR's Planet Money Summer School is in session. This season is all about investing. Like, is it better to buy a lot of one stock or a little bit of a lot of stocks? What are bonds? Is it ever too late to start investing? New classes every Wednesday till Labor Day in the Planet Money podcast feed.
New figures out today paint a mixed picture of an economy that is still struggling to find stability as the pandemic drags on. We've got Mike Regan here to help explain. He's senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Let's take these data points one at a time, shall we? The Commerce Department today reported a slowdown in the growth of consumer spending. Does that mean the economic recovery that had begun has so quickly lost its momentum?
A little bit. It's important to remember there's two major components of consumer spending. One is services, say airlines and hotels and restaurants. That number actually looked pretty good for this report, which, remember, is for July. So it's possible that spending slowed down further in August as the virus got worse. But for the July report, the other side of the consumer spending equation is physical goods and merchandise. And that was pretty weak in July. And I think part of that story is that we're still dealing with these supply bottlenecks around the world, really. Yeah. There was the shipping port closed in China and some factories closed. So certainly COVID is still holding things back compared to where they would be otherwise.
On the other hand, we got first-time jobless claims yesterday, and they ticked up very slightly, but they're still near the pandemic-era low from the previous week. And the government says household incomes rose by 1.1% in July, which I have to assume is a positive sign. Is this information evidence that the economy is strengthening?
Well, the sort of the peak of the recovery was in the second quarter when the economy grew at more than 12%. I mean, that's a pace unlike anything most of us have seen in our lifetime. So that was the high point, just because the vaccines had allowed the so many parts of the economy to reopen all at once. But for the rest of the year, the numbers have come down. The projections and forecasts for the rest of the year have come down a little bit. But they're still calling for about 6% growth in this current quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter of the year. And that's still very, very strong growth. So it has come off the peak that we saw earlier in the year, but still recovering very, very strongly for the rest of the year. At least that's the expectations.
On the other hand, Mike, the Supreme Court yesterday struck down the Biden administration's moratorium on evictions just after we learned on Wednesday that only about 11% of the housing aid that had been approved by the government was actually used for renters and landlords. How concerned are you about the effect this may have if thousands of people are suddenly homeless?
Yeah, it's definitely going to be noticeable. Some estimates in the hundreds of thousands of renters facing evictions. And mind you, that's apartments that could have full families in them. So
yeah.
I think it's going to have a very sort of uneven effect around the country because various states have various laws that affect the amount of time it actually takes to evict someone. And New York, for example, has very renter-friendly laws for this type of thing. Yeah. And there is the possibility that Congress could take this up and sort of supersede the Supreme Court's decision.
Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you.
At the end of this long and difficult week of news, you might be looking for something to soothe your spirit. Musician Rhiannon Giddens is here for you. The latest album from the Grammy winner and founding member of the Carolina Chocolate Drops is called They're Calling Me Home. It was recorded with her partner Francesco Torrisi, and it reaches back in time, putting a new spin on traditional songs like this fiddle tune called Waterbound.
Chickens crowing in an old pine tree. Chickens crowing in an old pine tree. Chickens crowing in an old pine tree down in North Carolina. Waterbound and I can't get home. Waterbound and I can't get home. Waterbound and I can't get home down in North Carolina.
I spoke with Rhiannon Giddens when the new album first came out in April. And I want to start with that song, Waterbound, and those lyrics. Waterbound and I can't get home down to North Carolina. They have so much resonance now in this year of the pandemic. How has this year of isolation been for you?
Oh, you know, I can't really complain. I'm in a place in my life and my career where enforced downtime hasn't been necessarily all a bad thing, but just the whole, you know, witnessing everything in the States, the pandemic, just seeing all the terrible things. It's been hard, but I can't even pretend to say that it's been as hard as I know it's been for a lot of people.
Yeah. You've been living in Ireland, in Limerick, but you are from North Carolina. Have you felt homesick in the past year?
No, for sure. I mean, it really makes you understand the difference between being, you know, in a home away from home, being able to visit your home country anytime you want and not being able to do that is pretty different. And it's really made me think a lot about the differences between expats, immigrants, and like refugees. You know, they're all very different experiences of being in a country that you didn't grow up in.
Let's hear some more music from the album. There are several mournful songs here to listen to. This one is Calling Me Home. It's written by Alice Gerard.
An old friend lay on his dying bed, held my hand and he whispered low as I bent my head, oh, they're calling me home. They're calling me home.
Alice Gerard has said that for her, that song is about pain, homage to one's elders and to the stories that they tell. What do you think about that? And why did it resonate with you?
It resonated with me because it's just such a true song. What I found is, you know, as we were, I'm, you know, kind of locked down, and this song, Calling Me Home, just kept coming and wanting to be sung. I found myself so comforted, oddly enough, by the truth in this song. I mean, it's really all about the inevitability of passing on, but facing that, you know, it is about pain, but it's about acceptance of that pain. And I just thought it was really beautifully written.
It is such a dirge, and I don't know if you feel this way, but it kind of reminded me of The Parting Glass, speaking of being in Ireland, a song you're pretty much guaranteed to hear at an Irish wake. How have you been reflecting on death over the past year?
Well, I mean, this music has been helping me. You know, I think that we have separated ourselves from death in a lot of ways. You know, just the way that we deal with it and the way that we don't have to deal with it in some ways, you know. You no longer lose half your children before they reach the age of 5. You know what I mean? It's like we are so spoiled. And so I think that it's come as quite of a shock. It's like, oh, you know, actually we're no different than the rest of humanity. We have to grapple with these things. And I think these old songs are really a good way to do that. It kind of connects us to those generations past to, you know, have already dealt with this. So it's like, oh, we're not alone, actually, you know?
Right, right, right. And here's another one of those old songs. Oh, Death. Very different sound, similar theme.
Oh, oh, Death. Oh, oh, Death in the morning. Oh, oh, Death. Spare me over till another year. Death walked up to the sinner's door. Said, now, sinner, you've got to go. The sinner looked around and began to cry. Said, oh, no, Death, I'm not ready to die. He's singing, no.
While the first one we listened to felt like it had roots in Ireland, this one sounds like it's coming right from the American South.
Absolutely. And, you know, the version that most people or a lot of people are familiar with is Ralph Stanley's version from O Brother, Where Art Thou, you know, which turned on a whole generation to the idea of American roots music. This version, there are obviously more African-American stylistic pieces to it, and I got it from Bessie Jones, and it just really spoke to me. And when I was performing it, when I was recording it, I was definitely reaching deep and feeling a connection. You know, that's exactly what I was saying earlier about that connecting to the ancestors, connecting to the generations that came before. It's like, this is deep, deep, deep stuff, you know, and those old songs really handle it better than any other thing. That's why they're still around. They really grapple with these things, like, in a perfect way.
Do they make you feel better?
Yeah, it's weird, right? Like,
it is.
It's something about listening to sad songs or songs that are really intense that do make you feel better, you know? Every culture has these songs that are laments. And it's like, why would you even do a lament if it did make you feel better? You know, otherwise you're just going to want to go lay down in a river and never get up. So
you're wallowing, yeah.
Yeah. What I think it does is it kind of releases some of those feelings that you have. You kind of experience them through the song. And then at the end, you know, you're a little bit lighter.
You have a couple of Italian songs here. Let's listen to one of them. This is Nena Nena, which you sing with your partner, Francesco Torisi.
Nena, 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 lupa sarielo in talavena. Si nun luva para tutta la vena sadda magna.
I understand that song is something that Francesco would sing to his daughter as a lullaby when she was a little girl. What has working with him recently brought to your music?
It's really brought a kind of a zoom out idea, you know? I've been so focused on, you know, African-American parts of American music and finding out it's just American music and it's just made up of all these different things. And then Francesco brings his perspective of coming from a Southern Italian family and then seeing the effect that, you know, Arabic culture and North African and Mediterranean culture had on Europe. And it's a thing that's kind of similarly suppressed, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic to African-American, you know, influence in American music. So there's a sort of a parallel story, and it just really connects me to the wider world and the idea that these stories are not happening in a vacuum. You know, before the transatlantic slave trade, there was the trans-Saharan Arabic slave trade. Before, you know, there was this, there was that. And so it's been a really amazing to connect with him and just kind of explore all those connection points.
Well, to that point on connectivity, I want to go out on this last song on the album, your version of Amazing Grace. That song blew me away because I was expecting something completely different. We hear your voice, but you never sing the lyrics, even though they're so iconic. Why not?
Yeah, that's why, right? Because everybody knows them. And so what it does, and this is, look, this is not what I was thinking when we did this. We did this and it was a total feeling. It was instinctive. It was emotional, you know? And then afterwards, you know, in terms of putting it on the record and thinking and ending it with it, it was like, well, everybody can then form their own experience of the song without the words. And there's so much weight to it that it then sort of allows everybody to engage the way they want to with it. I don't know. I was really happy with the way it turned out. We did it all live, bagpipes, yeah, voice, drum, all in one room. You know, couldn't hear myself. It was amazing, you know. And that feeling is what I want people to feel.
Rhiannon Giddens speaking with me back in April about her latest album, They're Calling Me Home, and she's giving us some comfort again today.
This week, the U.S. Capitol police officer who killed a pro-Trump rioter during the January 6th insurrection said he, quote, saved countless lives. Congressional testimony by other Capitol police officers last month supports evidence that the attack was spearheaded by right-wing extremists who came ready to do battle. And as we're about to hear, groups with racist beliefs that mirror those of the Ku Klux Klan, the Posse Comitatus, and others have persisted since the Civil War. Some of those groups have roots in rural states like Kansas, where, as Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service reports, some people feel abandoned, even victimized by their government. And a warning that this story contains language that may disturb some listeners.
Patrick Stein was angry after the last big recession, angry at the federal government for bailing out the big banks but not his failed business, and for standing by, as he saw it, as immigrants flooded into the country. So when Donald Trump used anti-immigrant rhetoric on his way to winning the presidency, Stein felt empowered. In the summer of 2016, he and some like-minded members of a Southwest Kansas militia group hatched a plot to blow up an apartment complex where Somali immigrants who had come to work in the region's meatpacking plants lived and worshipped. Stein called them cockroaches.
See, that whole apartment complex right there, it is, that's all that's in there.
Really?
Yep, cockroaches.
All of them.
Every f***ing apartment's full of them.
That's Stein talking to an FBI informant while driving by to scout the complex. He said he planned to detonate the bomb when the Muslim immigrants gathered to pray.
I'd give anything to have a camera set up that, you know, would Wi-Fi that to me so I could watch it live.
The FBI foiled the plot. Stein and two accomplices are now in federal prison. But the anti-government racist beliefs that motivated them have a history in Kansas and other rural states where small towns are shrinking and people, most of them white, fear a way of life is being lost. Fears, says Kansas historian Jim Leiker, fueled by a new kind of populism.
In the 1890s, the populist enemies were railroad barons, big corporations. In the last 50 years, what neo-populism has done is it's redefined who those elites are by saying that, well, the new elites are the liberals.
Liberals who welcome illegal immigrants and who push for cultural changes that many in rural areas see as threats to traditional American values.
These elements of white supremacy, white fear of demographic and cultural change have been very powerful.
Danny Levitas is the author of The Terrorist Next Door, a book that chronicles the rise of right-wing extremist groups over the last 50 years. He says the farm crisis of the 1970s and 80s was an inflection point in that history. Debt-strapped farmers were losing their land at rates not seen since the Great Depression. And some were drawn to conspiracy theories peddled by groups like the Posse Comitatus that blamed Jewish bankers and corrupt federal officials. Posse leaders William Gale and James Wickstrom trained militia groups across the country and spread their message in tapes played on rural radio stations.
The politicians have put you in bondage and you've sat back and let them do it.
This filthy Jew banking system is the most evil thing that ever came into the United States.
We're preparing for the war that's coming.
It was, Levitas says, a call to arms.
It was preaching that as white Anglo-Saxon Christians, they were the true descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. There was going to be a race war, and hand in hand with this international Jewish conspiracy were corrupt bureaucrats, and they should hang by the neck until dead.
Radical views embraced by former soldier Timothy McVeigh while stationed in Kansas at Fort Riley. A few years after his discharge in 1995, McVeigh and co-conspirator Terry Nichols drove a rental truck to a park near the fort and packed it full of explosives. McVeigh then headed south to Oklahoma.
There has been a massive explosion at a federal building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
The blast leveled the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building and killed 168 people. It remains the deadliest act of homegrown terrorism in U.S. history. McVeigh modeled his plan on the Turner Diaries, a dystopian novel written by William Pierce, a leader of the neo-Nazi National Alliance. The book, first published in 1978, is about white Americans fighting to take their country back from Jews and non-whites.
McVeigh followed the Turner Diaries almost to the letter.
University of Chicago historian Kathleen Ballou tracks the white power movement. On the NPR podcast Throughline, she said the book, though fiction, answered a key question for people in the movement.
And that question is, how could a small fringe movement hope to achieve what it set out to do in the 1980s and has been trying to do ever since, which is to violently overthrow the United States?
The mission of many in the mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol this past January.
It's our country we want it back!
The attack and attempts by some politicians to exploit the anger that fueled it reveal a disturbing evolution, says Jim Leiker, the Kansas historian. The racist anti-government beliefs that once thrived only on the political fringe have migrated to the mainstream.
Some of the coarse language has been softened to make it more appealing to wider groups of people. But the core idea is that your government can't be trusted. That's Dallaire, and I think it's a driving force behind what you saw on January 6th.
A force behind new extremist groups, which, like those that came before, are ready to go to war against their government. For Here and Now, I'm Jim McLean.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, wishing you a restful and safe weekend. It's Here and Now.